From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Here's something you might not know about Latinos.
We are the fastest growing group in the nation, but also in the labor movement.
So this week, we go to work and meet the woman who can find you when no one else can.
I can run very, very fast when I have to, even in chanclas.
And how do Latina executives navigate the corporate jungle?
It got to a point where my colleagues and my boss didn't think I had anything important to say. So I had to flex, and even though it was uncomfortable, if I had an idea, I needed to speak up.
All this and more coming up as we work it on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. No se vayan. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and this week, we're working it. Migrant workers, many of them Latino, work hard to get us the food we eat. Think about one very particular kind of food now, the date. It's sweet, easy to eat, but when it comes to harvesting a date, there's a lot that needs to be considered when it comes to worker safety. Just one example, summer temperatures can top 120 degrees. Reporter Lisa Morehouse now has more on Los Palmeros, the date palm workers.
Palm trees are a familiar sight in Southern California. Among the palms in the desert, none is more valuable than the date palm.
It's easy to get a little overwhelmed by date palm trees in the eastern Coachella Valley. They're everywhere, filling over 6,000 acres, and they rise 30, 50, even 70 feet. Dates arrived here around 1900 when the USDA sent agricultural explorers to Algeria, Iraq, and Egypt. They returned with date palm shoots and found the Coachella Valley climate perfect. Soon, farmers and business leaders decided consumers might find the Middle Eastern connection romantic. Theaters adopted Arabian themes. The town of Indio built a fairground with turrets and the old Baghdad stage. And towns were named Mecca, Thermal, and Oasis. One vestige of the agritourism is Oasis Date Garden near the town of Thermal. It sits like a mirage in the middle of 200 acres of palms. It's a working orchard and packing facility, but also a museum and cafe where visitors come for the valley's famous date shakes.
One date shake? Thank you.
All the medjools can be traced back to a single oasis in Morocco.
About 10 miles away from Oasis Date Garden, Doug Adair runs a small organic farm called Pato's Dream Dates.
And now it's one of the main crops. It's not my favorite, but for most people that like a really sweet dessert date, that's the Mercedes-Benz of the date family.
As he walks me through his date garden, Adair explains this isn't seasonal work. Fall is harvest time, but dates require year-round attention. The work cycle begins in January or February. First, the palmeros, or palm workers, have to make the trees safe to work in. They trim the crowns, ridding them of spines with huge thorns, which can impale shoes and flesh.
There's a story that God created the date palm in the Garden of Eden to benefit humanity, and then the devil came along and added the spines to show that he was going to punish the humans for indulging in this amazing fruit.
Workers collect pollen from male date palms and keep their eyes on the brown sheaths that look like tongues on the crests of female palms. These sheaths cover the date flowers.
And then as the flower matures, the sheath splits open. And so you can see the little yellow beads on the strands, on the hilos.
From afar, the flowers look like ears of corn. up close, like strings of yellow pearls. Now they're ready to pollinate.
There may be thorns here. Let's walk around this way.
We walk to where Adair's land meets his neighbors. Adair came to the Eastern Coachella Valley in the 70s when he was working for the United Farm Workers Union. When he bought a house with nine palms, he partnered with a palmero friend to learn to farm dates, and they split the harvest earnings.
Este es el hilo. Hilo para amarrar la flor. Este. Este es un mandil. Este es un cuchillo. Este y la punta.
That friend is now his neighbor and fellow date farmer, Francisco Pan y Agua. He's prepping his gear before climbing a ladder into the branches of a small palm to pollinate flowers.
When he goes up there, we'll cut that sheath away and then put the male pollen on the female flower.
Es el polen.
There are about 15 flowers on a palm, and Pan y Agua says he can do this task. Expose the flower, tie it, pollinate, plus do a little thinning along the way, in about 12 minutes per palm. Palmeros are considered an elite among farm workers, highly skilled, well-respected, and better paid.
La palma gana uno más que en cualquier otro empleo.
The average palmero makes about $25,000 to $30,000 a year. It's a well-paying job.
But one that comes at a cost.
Hay mucho peligro en la palma. Primero es la escalera.
Palm tree work is very dangerous. First, one must learn how to maneuver the ladder. It's very heavy, about 120 pounds. We have to carry it around. Then there are extremely sharp knives and machetes, countless things to be wary of.
He knows this from a very scary personal experience he had years ago.
One time I fell off the palm tree from about 35 feet high. I was up there trimming the thorns and, well, I fell feet first. I hurt my back, Pato remembers. I had to have surgery and was in the hospital for about 4 months.
There are stories of palmeros losing control of cumbersome ladders, suffocating under heavy, decaying palm fronds, even dying, falling from trees. Emmanuel Benitez, who works with California Rural Legal Assistance, believes the way workers are paid adds to the danger.
The workers work by piece rate. They are paid a certain price for each tree you do. So the more trees you do, the more money you're going to make.
And it's commonly thought palmeros work faster if they don't wear safety harnesses. When Benitez came to the valley in 1999, he was shocked to see palmeros working in 70-foot-tall trees without protection from falls. There weren't specific safety regulations for palmeros then. But Cal/OSHA formed a committee with date growers and advocates like Benitez and drafted safety codes, which went into effect in 2003. Now, along with other regulations, palmeros must wear safety harnesses, and the ladders they climb, which are permanently affixed to the palms, must meet certain specifications. Benitez says he rarely sees employers in violation of the regulations now. Despite these protections, Francisco Pan y Agua is clear about the qualities someone still needs to be a palmero.
Valor. Mucho valor.
Courage.
A lot of energy, especially in the summer because it's very hot. 110, 120, 122, 123 degrees. A lot of courage and a lot of strength is needed to work with palm trees.
For Latino USA, I'm Lisa Morehouse in the Eastern Coachella Valley.
Work can be inherently dangerous, but for the 20 million Latinos working in America, it's even riskier. Latinos are more likely to die on the job than all other American workers. And sadly, that's true in every single occupation. Latino USA producer Brenda Salinas dives deeper into this terrifying statistic.
For construction workers, grueling manual labor is just another workday. But no one expects to be seriously injured before the end of their shift.
Estaba trabajando yo en la construcción. Mi propio mayordomo me lesionó con un taladro industrial.
Luis Rodriguez was a construction worker in Texas.
Habíamos que cortar un pedazo de plywood de 2 pulgadas para que llegara al límite de la altura de la calle.
One morning, he was helping cut a large piece of plywood when the foreman holding the drill slipped.
Fue a parar a mi dedo índice de la mano derecha.
It cut straight through his index finger. There was no other choice but to amputate.
Y yo no lo sentía, entonces el doctor decidió y contó conmigo, ¿verdad? Que era mejor imputármelo.
Statistically speaking, Luis was lucky. Latino workers are more likely to be fatally injured than all other workers in the country. That's 14% more likely. The number is twice as high for Latino immigrants. They die in transportation accidents, especially crashes. They face violence on the job. Some are injured by equipment, like Luis, and others suffer falls, like Santiago Barrientos.
Mi supervisor, mi mayordomo, me exigió que fuera a ayudarles a otras gentes a descargar un trailer.
He was unloading heavy equipment in a Texas factory when he slipped.
Me nomás sentí el tronado en mi cadera y...
He felt a pop in his hip, and he couldn't sit, much less walk. He was crying out for help. The other workers just laughed at him.
Me corrieron del trabajo porque no podía, la verdad. En ese trabajo no podía estar yo porque estaba muy pesado.
The next day, he showed his boss the letter from the doctor, saying he couldn't carry more than 5 to 10 pounds at a time. He was fired. A recent report by the Labor Council for Latin American Advancement found that these types of workplace injuries are more common with smaller contractors. Those happen to be the companies that are more willing to hire immigrant day laborers. They don't always provide the legally required training and safety equipment. Making it worse, immigrants are less likely to report unsafe working conditions. They're afraid of employer retaliation and deportation.
Uno también tiene los mismos derechos que las personas de aquí, no más que... Pues, desgraciadamente, uno es ilegal, pero somos humanos.
Luis Rodriguez says it's because they don't speak English and they don't know that there's help for them. We have the same rights, he says. Even though we're undocumented, we're human. It's not just men who face tough working environments. The American Journal of Industrial Medicine found that Latina housekeepers have the highest injury rate in the country. There's worse. Hector Sanchez is the executive director of the LCLAA.
We found in a number of industries is a drastic increase in sexual harassment and rape in the workplace.
And when a breadwinner is injured, it affects the whole family. Here's Luis again.
No había entrada de dinero para pagar renta, luz, todo.
Because he couldn't work, he couldn't pay rent or utilities. He's back working now. Santiago is still recovering, but when he does get back to work, he wants more than just a job.
Que nos escuchen aquí de todos Estados Unidos, que nos apoyen a todos los trabajadores.
He says he wants people to listen to his story so that there can be fair laws for everybody. There's optimism in their story, too. Nationally, the Obama administration passed more laws to protect whistleblowers against employer retaliation. That's in large part thanks to the work of OSHA and the LCLAA. Hector Sanchez again.
If we stick together and we are united, we can make sure that we have better working conditions for everybody working in the domestic workers, the restaurant industry, the retail industry, and agriculture.
The challenge isn't just institutional. It's getting the word out, letting Latinos and Latinas know that even without papers, they have rights. For Latino USA, I'm Brenda Salinas.
Coming up on Latino USA.
I am the one who provides for my children, so it was very hard for me. I was like crying on the train.
How domestic workers in New York change their circumstances by working together. Stay with us. Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. What happens if you don't hold a Latina back? If she never hears, "You can't do that"? Well, you might get someone like Michelle Gomez. Gomez is a skip tracer. That means she finds people who are on the run. People, or sometimes things, that have skipped town. Gomez uses public records, online databases, and some old-fashioned sleuthing to track fugitives down. And she only takes cases that others have been unable to crack. Gomez was recently profiled in Wired magazine and joins us from the studios of KUT in Austin, Texas. Welcome to Latina USA, Michelle.
Thank you.
How did you even get into this? You don't just stumble upon this kind of a career.
I've always was intrigued by putting things together without instruction. I've always put things together easily, just came natural. And I was born into a family of engineer. We also have a family in law. So with those two unique DNAs, you can become somebody special. And I guess I'm special. God gave me a gift. Back in 2001, 2002, the word skip tracer surfaced. And I never even heard of the word skip tracer. At this time, when they proposed this job to me, I was uncomfortable. But when I began to see the success, and you can separate your two, the job and your personal life, you become a pro. And after a year, I opened up my own business and success came daily. The cases became harder. And here I am today on the radio with you.
So can you just describe, you know, what you look like?
I'm 4'11". I'm very petite. I'm thin. I'm very fit. I can run very, very fast when I have to, even in chanclas, if you have to say. I'm prepared to run, and I'm prepared for anything. I have game plan A, B, and C backed up. If I'm in a position that I've put myself in danger or something in a location or a neighborhood, I'm a normal person. I'm a mother. I have short hair. I have to change my look all the time. I am doing a man's job. That would take a lot of bravery to confront people in the neighborhoods that are less fortunate. And it is quite scary, though. I don't know if I'm going to come back sometimes safe. And so my mother's always worried. Michelle, when are you leaving? Are you protected? I'm like, yes, I'm protected. I have security with me, or I have this, or I have that. And I always come home with a smile. I have my case closed. I have, you know, a location of where my subject is at. I report it to my client and I'm on to the next case until this is brewing, or I have to, you know, each case has to have patience. So I always have to be careful of how much persistence I take to each case depends on my patience, because sometimes I do get antsy. And once I know I want to locate or pin my subject down, I still have to give patience to that case, because if you're too hasty, you can ruin information.
Yeah, but you didn't tell me what happens when you do feel that fear, when all of a sudden, I mean, you sometimes, Michelle,
I do the sign of the cross. I'm like, Dios ayúdame, because, you know, sometimes, you know, you don't know if you're going to come out successful. Sometimes there's dogs. That's why when you do recon or surveillance, you have to see what's there. Is there going to be an animal? Is there going to be a dog? What kind of dog? I have to either come with my baloney or a treat or something. I always take two or three trips before I actually do the recovery.
That's so cute. So you actually carry baloney in your bag sometimes if you know there's going to be.
I carry bacon, dog treats, baloney. I am always prepared. You have to be prepared. If you don't go prepared, you're not going to come back successful.
So we've been talking a lot about STEM, particularly with Latinas. And one of the things that's come up is that a lot of the Latinas who are basically graduating now with STEM degrees, there's just no one who has, in fact, created this path. So for you, are you becoming a mentor now?
Well, we've always been, I guess, labeled as minorities. And I don't think that that's even true anymore, because we are out there. We just have to be stronger, more independent. We have to be wiser. We have to take our knowledge and expand it and show it to our kids, show it to strangers, show it to Latinas that need that self-esteem, that brightness in us. A lot of us have that lack of self-confidence. And it just takes that one person to say, you can do it. Anything is possible. And if you get up in the morning and wake up to say, today I'm going to do this and I'm going to conquer it, and you do it, you accomplish your own fears, you can do anything. And there's nothing impossible in this world that a Latina cannot do.
Well, thank you so much, Michelle. It was great talking to you.
Thank you. It was great talking to you, Ms. Hinojosa.
Michelle Gomez is a skip tracer who was recently profiled in Wired magazine. She joined us from the studios of KUT in Austin, Texas. Gracias de nuevo, Michelle. That was great.
Gracias. Thank you.
Worker cooperatives, businesses owned and operated by their members, aren't a new idea. In the U.S., they started popping up around the turn of the 20th century. But worker co-ops have seen real growth in the last decade, driven in part by Latinos. Bruce Wallace reports from Sunset Park, an immigrant neighborhood in Brooklyn.
Si se puede, this is Juan.
It's early afternoon at Si Se Puede's office, and the phones are getting a workout.
Right, so this is an apartment or a house we're talking about?
Juan Aldway is taking a call from a new customer.
How many floors?
Types the details into a brightly colored spreadsheet. Next to him, Odalis Bonifacio calls workers to see if they can pick up the new jobs.
Hola, buenos días. ¿Cómo está, Mónica? Bien, gracias. Quería saber, ¿usted está disponible para mañana?
It seems like your typical home cleaning agency, but there's a difference.
Okay, no hay problema.
Here, the workers are the bosses.
Okay. Gracias. Que tenga un buen día. Bye.
The co-op was started in 2006 with the official name Si Se Puede Women's Cooperative We Can Do It, Inc. Its founders had guidance from the Center for Family Life, a local social service agency. The women, 13 Latinas and one Bangladeshi, were tired of the low pay and fickle bosses typical of domestic work. Today, there are nearly 60 members, all immigrants and nearly all Latina, many from countries with a strong tradition of working cooperatively. Twice a month, they pack into a small conference room to hash out the nuts and bolts of their operation, how to expand and what to spend money on and when and who to hire. It's a lot of commitment, but the women say it's worth it.
It's about the income that you are making.
Erlinda Flores joined Si Se Puede a year and a half ago after she lost another cleaning job and was out of work for 4 months.
I am the one who provides for my children, so it was very hard for me. I was like crying on the train.
Before Si Se Puede, Erlinda was making $8 an hour. Now it's over 20. Besides that, the co-op's flexible schedule means more time with her kids. Rates and working conditions are spelled out in a contract that customers sign up front. And there are other benefits. Yadira Fragoso, a member for 5 years, says she sees her coworkers change.
Like, for example, I remember Erlinda, when she started, she was kind of shy to when she stand up on the front of all the members. And now I see her more, she can talk more confident and all the things. And I see that in myself and a lot of the other members.
Yadira herself has become an activist of sorts.
Earlier, Penny Lewis mentioned
when a group of co-op advocates gathered in Manhattan to network and raise awareness, Yadira told the crowd how Si Se Puede had changed things for her.
Bueno, como ya lo mencionó, yo soy una miembro de la cooperativa Si Se Puede.
Co-op numbers are growing not just in New York, but nationally. In 2012, a rough count by the U.S. Federation of Worker Cooperatives found up to 350 nationwide, many of them new. Director Melissa Hoover says Latino-run co-ops account for a lot of that growth.
With a lot of immigrant groups and the work that they have access to, it, you know, is vulnerable jobs, difficult work, and it's work that can be really improved by owning your job yourself.
As Si Se Puede grows, making decisions collectively gets more cumbersome. But still, the women say it's worth it. Another reason? Getting props from their kids. Erlinda Flores' son compares her to one of the characters on The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills.
He told me, you remember that lady, and I asked him, why? He said, because she came like you. She came from her country without speaking English, and look at her. You look like her. And that's made me very, very proud of myself, too.
For Latino USA, I'm Bruce Wallace in New York.
And now, mis queridos, on to the Midwest. In Michigan, Governor Rick Snyder is already planning his reelection campaign. And one thing he's touting? The effectiveness of Michigan's right-to-work law, passed just over a year ago. That law, you may remember, spawned massive protests across the state. It also renewed national debate over right-to-work laws versus unions. Michigan became the 24th state to pass right-to-work laws. But there can be some confusion about what right-to-work means exactly and what it doesn't mean. To help explain, here's Latino USA producer Michael Simon Johnson.
Actually, I've never said unions are bad for business, and I don't believe this is actually anti-union. If you look at it, I believe this is pro-worker.
That's Michigan Governor Rick Snyder on MSNBC in late 2012 after he signed a law making his state the 24th right-to-work state in the country.
This is about the relationship between unions and workers, and this is about giving workers the freedom to choose, and unions have to be in a position to present a good value proposition. If you look at
Snyder, who is Republican, announced his re-election campaign this month. He's staking at least some of his hopes on the fact that his labor policy changes have brought over 200,000 jobs to Michigan, many of them in the manufacturing industry. In Tennessee last week, workers at a Volkswagen plant in Chattanooga voted by a hair to reject an offer by the United Automobile Workers to represent them as a union.
That between the two institutions, Volkswagen and the UAW, I know of not one incident of any aggression or animosity.
In doing so, they exercised Tennessee's right-to-work laws and their right to choose whether they want a union to represent them at all. And last September, a large group of mostly Latino fruit farmers in Fresno County, California, which is not a right-to-work state, protested their union, the United Farm Workers. They claimed they'd been unfairly represented, and they didn't even want a union.
They're not asking us if we want it or we're not. They're forcing us to have the union, and we don't want that. We have the right to vote, to choose.
All this being said, unions are not yet a thing of the past. In fact, it is Latinos and other non-white groups that are shaping up to be the future of unions. In 2012, 156,000 Latino workers joined unions or took union jobs. But what these new unions will look like, how much influence and authority they'll have, and how lasting they can be, will depend greatly on right-to-work laws. But to understand right-to-work laws, we need to go back to where they came from.
Remember what the president said about Uncle Sam already spending at the rate of $100 million a day on this war? That's a lot in anybody's language. But before this war is over, we've got to double it.
During World War II, American labor organizations, from factory workers to railroad workers to coal workers, were largely committed to a no-strike pledge. There was a general agreement that ending the war by expediting labor was more important than whatever labor unions wanted.
Production is rolling, and every day new production lines are swinging into action, making things faster, faster and better, producing more for victory.
The American Federation of Labor, which would later become the AFL-CIO, even stated that to cease production is to strike at the very heart of the nation. But once the war ended, so did the no-strike pledge. All the pent-up tension between overworked, underpaid laborers and their employers, between unions and management, exploded in a wave of post-war labor strikes.
Western Electric employees swell the growing total of striking workers throughout the country. Less than 15% of messages are being handled in the New York area.
Between 1945 and 1946, there were well over 9,000 strikes by about 8 million workers across the country. So Congress passed the Labor Management Relations Act of 1947, better known as the Taft-Hartley Act, to curb the power gained by unions.
The Taft-Hartley Act was written for only one purpose: to restore justice and equality in labor management relations.
Primarily,
it got rid of the closed shop.
That's Moshe Marvit.
I'm a fellow at the Century Foundation, specialized in labor and employment law and policy.
A closed shop was when labor unions demanded that employers only hire union members. It was a way of securing union power over employers. With the Taft-Hartley Act, that was now illegal.
And what it did was, it created the possibility of security clauses where the employer can hire anyone it wants, whether from the union or from outside the union, but within some time frame, that new employee has to join the union or pay the fair share provision.
That's called a union shop. And opponents of it argued that it created what's called a forced rider problem. Under a union shop, in order to work, you had to join a union, or at least financially support a union, even if you didn't want to. But the law had a loophole. It allowed states to pass laws banning union shops. And states that choose to do that are called right-to-work states.
In a right-to-work state, even if a union has won the election and represents the workers, if you are a new employee there, an old employee, you don't have to join, you don't have to pay any fees.
But even if you don't join the union still has to represent you and your interests as a worker, meaning you get all the benefits of being in the union without actually having to pay for those benefits. That's one way to define a right-to-work state. And this, of course, creates a problem as well.
It's just human nature that if you don't have to pay for something, you won't. It's similar to public radio in a sense. I thought of public radio because here in Pittsburgh, we just came off of a membership drive.
Because, you know, listening to public radio without donating is like eating a dinner at an exquisite gourmet restaurant and then not paying the bill, just walking right
and
out of there.
It always strikes me that all the arguments they use on public radio about, you know, don't free ride, you know, pay for it, you listen to it all the time, you take it for granted, are the same arguments that unions have to make in right-to-work states. The only difference is on public radio, they essentially stop production. You know, you don't get the news as you normally would for that period where they have the pledge drive. Unions can't. They have to still represent all the workers. And so they really have no means to get a worker to pay. And so people just don't because, you know, why pay for something if you don't have to?
So where union shops created the forced rider problem, right to work creates the free rider problem. But there's more. Marvitt says that in the 1930s, part of the right to work movement was rooted in racism, a fear that encouraging unions would lead to economic partnership between working class whites and blacks. One anti-union Texas businessman even claimed that, quote, white women and white men will be forced into organizations with black African apes, whom they will have to call brother or lose their jobs, unquote.
If you look at the overlap of the states that have, you know, traditionally been the most racist and the states that are right to work, it's shocking. I mean, there's no denying that there is a relationship.
By that, Marvitt means that every former Confederate state is also now a right to work state.
I mean, that was one of the early and sort of remains in the backdrop of right-to-work laws, even. The idea that's always put forward is this idea of forced association with people you don't want to associate with.
For undocumented workers, this is taken to the next level.
Undocumented workers can form labor unions, you know, just like anyone else, but if they're discriminated against for doing so and they take their claim to court like other workers would, they're not allowed to receive any back pay or any remedies because that would conflict with federal immigration law. So the idea being that they had no right to earn that money in the first place, and so they shouldn't receive, you know, any kind of remedy in return.
This all has led to speculation on the left that right to work's purpose is to drain unions by having so many free riders that unions can no longer afford to exist, while supporters of right to work argue that it's simply a matter of individual worker freedom. For Latino USA, I'm Michael Simon Johnson.
Coming up on Latino USA,
it almost feels like a cartoonist picked up a camera and decided to take a photograph of what he thought a working mom looked like.
Can stock photography portray women fairly? And what about women of color? Stay with us on Latino USA. No se vayan.
Es el rey de las fragancias subversivas. Humos color malva, adicción de los apilas, de las brujas y las magas, escarlata que calcina, gemas colocadas, su lengua hipnotiza porque es una eterna banda donde hombres peregrinan, miradas llenas de rabia bajo la coreografía de los disfraces oscos, el eclipse abriga, la gran sombra es de Moloch, párpado metálico, desciende sin fatiga, las paredes se encienden, repletas de pupilas, abrazan las paredes. Paredes de camas desabridas, la calle hacia el trabajo dura toda una vida. El perenne martirio de una pena colectiva, fumando niños va como cannabis activa. Emana humillo bajo su mirada fría. Padres y críos en el cielo se expiran, mastican sonrisas. Mon-
Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Only 46 of the Fortune 1000 companies' CEOs are women, and not a single one is a Latina. Of course, Latinas face a lot of the same barriers in the corporate world that all women do. But are there things about Latino culture that make it even harder for its women to reach the top spots? From New York, Mariel Segarra reports.
Josie Lassa Gallagher heads out of a chauffeured car and into a posh Brooklyn brownstone. It's the headquarters of Future Work Institute, the diversity consulting firm where she works. Josie lives in Virginia, but as an executive coach, she's here, there, and everywhere during the week. Upstairs, there's a giant TV screen for video conferencing and a desk that can double as a makeshift bed.
I usually actually work here. I plop myself on that sofa with my laptop. I mean, our laptop is our life.
As a former executive at Hewlett-Packard and Global One, Josie's used to the grind, and she loves her job. But as a Latina, there are things about the way she was raised that made it harder for her to find her place in corporate America.
I observed certain things in my home. For instance, when we were having dinner, my mother always served my father first. If we had male guests, they would get served first.
Josie's Afro-Cuban. She's 62, and she's lived in the U.S. for most of her life.
So nobody said anything, but it's just some observations around the male and the female role. You know, there's certain things that you pick up, and that then goes with you when you go into the corporate world.
When Josie started her first job at Union Carbide 40 years ago, she couldn't bring herself to call her boss by his first name, no matter how many times he asked her to. She also kept her mouth shut during meetings.
It got to a point where my colleagues and my boss didn't think I had anything important to say, so I had to flex. And even though it was uncomfortable, if I had an idea, I needed to speak up. And even today, it's not comfortable, but I know I have to do it.
That's the thing. Latinas who make it to the executive suite can have trouble shaking these ingrained ideals of deference and politeness. But most Latinas never do make it there. Josie gets that. And she's not the only one.
I am Lisa Sanchez.
Lisa's 37. She works for Ernst & Young.
I am an EY advisory partner based out of the Fort Worth office in Texas.
Lisa was born in Panama and moved to the U.S. after high school. Like Josie, she's always working to balance the expectations of her job with those of her culture. Sometimes that means she gets the side eye from her husband's family.
I have my father-in-law or my husband's grandmother visiting from Costa Rica. But Monday comes and I'm packing my bags, going on an out-of-town trip for 4 nights.
Then they ask questions like,
how often do you travel? Because they really are trying to get to how much are these kids being unattended? How much is this household being unattended? That's kind of really what's underlying that.
Josie and Lisa don't know each other. They grew up decades and states apart. But as girls, they heard a lot of the same messages about the role of women. That's what led Josie and a few friends to start a network for Latina executives more than a decade ago. They call the group Madrinas, Spanish for godmothers. They chat by conference call.
If you've just joined us, this is the Madrina call.
Today, a woman who works at Ford, goes to business school at night, and has a 2-year-old son asks how to balance it all. She gets this advice.
It's kind of like you can't have everything at the same time, but you can have everything.
Madrinas member Magda Irizarry says Latinas shouldn't be ashamed to be ambitious.
Do you know what I mean? Because right. As soon as you start to let that guilt and doubt get in, we have too many people who are going to feed on that.
That might include other Latinos, perhaps especially when one of them is a man and one is a woman.
I'll probably get a lot of flack from it from my fellow Latinos out there. But at the end of the day, we have a certain expectation level of our Latina woman.
That's Ken Arroyo Roldan, an executive recruiter in New York.
So when you start seeing women climb to the top of the ladder, and that woman happens to be a Latina, sometimes they may be a little bit that knee-jerk reaction to say, hey, listen, that should be my role, and that woman should be at home taking care of the kids and cooking the meal.
This isn't true of all Latinos. Ken says he's a feminist, and he thinks there are a lot of other guys like him. He also thinks things will change as the younger generation moves up in the workplace. That's what Josie is banking on. Back in Brooklyn, she zips up her suitcase and heads out the door to a consulting gig in Pennsylvania.
I'll sit up front.
Josie says when she meets younger Latinas, she sees progress.
They have a whole different view, and so there's more of I can do it and less baggage that they're carrying.
And Josie learns from that. She says working with these women makes her respect herself more, and it gives her hope. For Latino USA, I'm Marielle Segarra in New York.
Do an experiment with me. Go into Google and search for working mom. Yeah, okay, I'll wait. Go get your computer and search working mom. So what do you see? A woman in a really bad pantsuit feeding a crying toddler in a kitchen while talking on a huge, like, brick-sized cell phone? A woman struggling to hold a baby in a briefcase? And why are there rollers in her hair? All right, now do a search for woman executive. Get the picture? It's a problem that Sheryl Sandberg wants to fix. She's partnering with Getty Images, the largest provider of these photos, to create a collection of photos that depict women in more empowering ways. Our favorite fashion blogger, Veronica Marche Miller, joins us from the studios of WHYY in Philadelphia to talk about why this is such a big deal. Veronica, welcome back to Latino USA.
Thanks for having me.
Look, I'm a mother of two. I know all about the juggling and the nursing while you're working and all that. But at the same time, those stock photos that you find, like in the past, it just looks so unrealistic and unappealing.
Oh, yeah. The stock photos that we're so used to seeing online, it almost feels like a cartoonist picked up a camera and decided to take a photograph of what he thought a working mom looked like. It's funny that you mentioned the mom who is juggling all sorts of things. There's also the stock photographs where they actually Photoshop extra arms onto a woman to show how much she's juggling and how stressed out she is.
How much do you think that they impact our perceptions of women?
I do think they can have an effect because these are the images, the stock photo images that newspapers, blogs, websites, they have to use these images because they can't afford to hire a photographer, professional models, or anything like that. So they just have to use this very limited availability of photos to try to get their point across. And oftentimes, the images are to a detriment of that.
Mm. So not seeing ourselves portrayed accurately in the media, I don't know. I know a several thousand women of color, Latinas, who would be like, yeah, we are
never accurately
portrayed.
Absolutely. I was looking for like a Black woman who maybe looked like a creative professional giving a presentation. And it became just laughable. It's always this Black woman with her arms crossed in this Black plain suit looking at you like, if you say anything wrong, I'm going to come for you. And that's not what I was looking for at all.
It's funny because I haven't done a search for that, but it's like, yeah, I've seen that image.
Yeah, yeah. And it's the one that permeates, you know, that's the one that's across every stock site that you can look up.
So we talked to Adriana Gaspar. She created a very popular style Latino Tumblr. And this is what she had to say about this.
I really was just looking for a website that just focused on Latino people. And then I did not find one after doing some extensive researching, and I just decided if there wasn't one, then I would create one.
I mean, it is hopeful, right? That maybe this generation is saying, okay, look, we know it's hard to juggle, but you have got to find that moment of we're alive, it's a joyful time, we've got to make ourselves feel that way. And that's kind of a reflection of this generation, I guess I would say.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think women, I can speak for myself, Black women in particular, are tired of being portrayed as not being happy. So I think seeing these women in these authentic situations and oftentimes just looking content is a big step.
Well, we're all about creating our own images and our own narratives. So thanks for helping us do that. You as well, Veronica. So we appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Veronica Marche Miller is a fashion blogger for XOJane.com. She joined us from the studios of WHYY in snowy Philadelphia. And now we're going to talk about someone who not only works it, but bends it. Yes, mis queridos, David Beckham. The soccer star has been generating excitement in Miami since he announced several weeks ago that he plans on bringing a Major League Soccer team to the city. A soccer team in a city that already knows it as football seems like an obvious win. But to find out, we turn to Cesar Diaz. He's the editor-in-chief of Latino Sports. He's here to discuss the team's prospects and what the new franchise could mean for Miami. Cesar Diaz, it's great to have you back on Latino USA.
Thank you. I'm happy to be back.
All right. So why are people so excited about this new team in Miami? I mean, I'm not Miss Sports Lady here, but I've heard all about it. What's going on?
The buzz is David Beckham recently decided to exercise his clause, and now he's going to be an owner of a Major League Soccer franchise in Miami.
Yeah, but is it because it's Beckham? Is it because it's Miami? And this is, you know, the northern capital of Latin American cities. And so everybody loves soccer. Which one is it? Or am I putting it in the wrong boxes?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, let's be honest. I mean, David Beckham is like the Ricky Martin of England. The guy has some serious Austin Powers mojo that, you know what I mean? You see him on H&M.
Okay, I don't really like the guy myself. I happen to think it's way over the top. But okay, Austin Powers mojo. Got it. We also know that star players don't necessarily make the best owners all the time. What makes it such a clear picture that this is going to be a success?
Well, one thing about Beckham is that he's always had the right people managing his affairs. I mean, he's one of these players that you rarely hear about getting caught in a scandal. His agents are Simon Fuller, so they're the guys who helped produce the American Idol. One thing that David Beckham has made clear is that he wants the stadium privately funded, and he also wants the team to be part of the community. From what I've seen of him and what I've known of him and spoken with others is that he's just the type of individual where he has the right people in his corner. The original team they used to have was the Miami Fusion. And they were there for, and they ended up folding in 2001. So this is really the second time that an MLS franchise is being proposed in Miami. You know, it goes back to what we discussed. Will this be a team that's actually going to do some grassroots work, or are they going to try spoon feed you the team? It may work with other, it may work with baseball, it may work with football, the NBA, where you can spoon feed the audience. But those sports already has a foundation here in the United States.
So is this, you know, your dream, Caesar? Is it coming true that soccer is gaining popularity in the United States? I know that's your dream, Caesar. So is this a hint of like, watch what's happening in Miami?
Well, soccer's always been popular. Soccer to me is a lot like the Latino population. You know, all of a sudden we're a sleeping giant. No, we've always been there. It's just that we're finally being acknowledged. People are finally walking and seeing the wallpaper and saying, wow, it's got life, it's got character.
So is it just Latinos in the U.S. who are watching soccer or really, because that's what, when you and I went to the game here in New York, that's what I was like, oh my God, is it just Latinos or?
No, it's everybody. I mean, the reason we look at it more on, we focus more on Latinos because, you know, we're pretty much one of the bigger minority groups here in the United States. But, you know, I mean, I've gone to games where you have Asians there, you have Africans there. I mean, you have people from Europe. So it's definitely very diverse. But I just think it depends the state that you're at and the demographics.
So you have high hopes for Miami?
Yes and no. My concern is with any state, and I'm looking at it more not for the team itself, but more for the stadium. You know, and the questions that I always ask when I hear about let's build a stadium, well, one, how does it benefit the community? Will the community respond to it? Because, yeah, it'll create jobs right off the bat, but, you know, and I'm sure the unions would love it. But what afterwards, though? Are there going to be full-time jobs or are there going to be part-time jobs? You know, I think right now it's a lot of questions that it's too early to tell, but I always say to any fan, you know, just because a stadium sounds good doesn't necessarily mean it's what's best for the community.
Caesar, I couldn't let you go without asking you a question about what's happening in Brazil in the run-up to the World Cup this summer. A lot of protests. So tell us why. And then on the sports side of it, does the U.S. even have a chance to do anything at the World Cup this time around?
Brazilians are angry, you know. I mean, you have a lot of Brazilians protesting because, you know, the government, and I, you know, even though people are upset with FIFA about it, the World Cup organizers, but I'm like, well, if the government had done their job to take care of the communities, provide better schools, better hospitals, better education, you wouldn't have the ongoing protests. You got the transportation, like you can go to, anyone can go to YouTube and see that. The government recently, I guess the metro, whatever, recently raised the fare. So what Brazilians started to do, they just started hopping over the turnstile. I mean, I would love to see that happen here in New York where MTA raises fare and New Yorkers are like, you know what? F this, man. Let's hop over it.
Because guess what? But you're always looking for that. Now, how high will New Yorkers jump to get over that turnstile?
Let's measure it. Crawl underneath it, you know?
All right. So does the U.S. have a chance this time in the World Cup?
It's going to be tough because they are in the group of death with Portugal, Germany, and Ghana. And Ghana, the last few World Cups have been they've been the team that have eliminated the United States from the World Cup, and that's our first opponent. Yes, ours. Because you know what, though? I am an American. I am proud of my Latino heritage, but I'm also proud of our boys in the our Yanks. So stars and stripes all the way. If you don't like it, send me the hate mail, whatever. We'll talk football.
Cesar Diaz, thanks so much for coming back on Latino USA.
Thank you.
And finally, mis queridos, it's time for a little sabiduría, or words of wisdom. This week, our show was all about work, and so it seemed fitting that we would hear from a lion of the labor movement. Cesar Chavez co-founded the National Farm Workers Association with Dolores Huerta. At the time, they helped Americans understand that the rights of workers were a civil rights issue. And while Latinos are now the fastest growing group in the labor movement, Latino workers themselves still face real hardships. Not only are Latinos more likely to die of job injuries, they also face more violations of minimum wage and overtime pay than any other group, and that's known as wage theft. All of that is in addition to facing higher rates of poverty and unemployment than their white counterparts, according to the Labor Council for Latin American Advancement. So today, we hear Cesar Chavez on boycotts and what it takes to make a change in work.
Meaningful change takes a lot of struggle, a lot of time, a lot of dedication. That's what happens. Look at the struggles that really mean, have really done something in this world. Look how long it takes them. It doesn't happen by rhetoric, especially through rhetoric. It doesn't happen. It happens when people get out there, roll up their sleeves, and actually get the work done. And so we say, why go to the politicians? Why not go directly and go to the marketplace where you can put direct pressure on those corporations that can find a solution for you? That, we recommend that. We live long enough to know that it works.
Sabiduría from Cesar Chavez. And here's wishing all of you a lot of productive, meaningful, and fulfilling work, because we love working for you. Latino USA is produced by AC Valdez, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Brenda Salinas, Jonathan Wolf, and Michael Jones. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our interns are Antonia Cerejido and Daniel Gunter. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Additional engineering this week by Stephanie LeBeau. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa, from our studios in Harlem. And join us again next week. And in the meantime, find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. Hasta la próxima.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. Latino USA's tech coverage is supported by the CAPOR Center for Social Impact, which leverages technology for positive, progressive change. Tech for good, good for tech. CAPORCenter.org.
I would kill for that.
I'll
right
take
now.
That.
Yeah.
Don't let them lure you. Houston's awful.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Lumber Liquidators, supporting the Ronald McDonald House Charities, the National Braille Press, and NPR. Information at lumberliquidators.com. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing exceptionally creative individuals. This year's MacArthur Fellows are at macfound.org. The William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives. On the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.